This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we have a very special guest. Her name is Linda Fairstein. She's a New York Times bestselling author. 15 novels. It's hard to believe it's been that many. The new one's called Death Angel, and it's got a really spooky cover. Hello, how are you?
I'm great, David. Really good to talk to you again.
I want to see, is this a real place on the cover?
Yes. The book is set in Central Park, as you know, and which I think is the heartbeat of New York City, the real centerpiece. And that the murder, without spoiling anything, the dead woman is found in the first chapter in the lake in Central Park. So the lake is right at 72nd Street, and over the lake is this iconic statue, the small statue under the arches, and she is called the Angel of the Waters, and it's from a biblical term in the King James Bible. She's watching over keeping the water safe, and not in this case, but and the arches, the actual evil-looking arches in which she's framed, are the Bethesda Terrace. It's one of the most glorious spots in the park, and so they actually use the real location, which I love, framing the book jacket where the murder occurred.
I should mention it's out from, and your new book is out from Dutton. It's such a fact, and the Central Park is such a big theme in this book, and it's wonderful. And I've never been to Central Park. I've been near it, but I don't think I've ever been in it. But just reading of all these facts and figures, the number of visitors a year, the budget, I didn't even know it had a budget.
Right. Well, you know, I in most of my books, I try and my own choice of branding, to explore some aspect of New York City. And whether it's people who live there and know the city, I lived right around the park, still do, for 40 of the years that I've been in the city. And I think I know it well, but I didn't know there were caves in the park. It's all man-made. And then I get a ton of mail from readers who've never been to New York, from people overseas who will never get to New York. And what they respond to, fortunately for me, is the sense of place. I mean, everybody's heard of Central Park. Everybody's seen pictures of it or concerts set there and or heard about crimes there. So it's fun for me to use a real setting that has an interesting, rich history, as well as, you know, the dark side where crimes occur.
Right. So it's good for both.
Yes. For me, it worked well.
What's interesting about this book is how interesting it gets as it goes along. I mean, it starts out and then it just builds. The way you build the tension is wonderful. I really like that. And Alexandra is having a lot of problems in this book.
She is. She is really overwhelmed in this book. And, you know, of course, that's how I wanted it to be. You make it more interesting. It's, as you know, when you do a series, trying to evolve the characters and keep them interesting for the readers who come back to see these people, but they want them to change and grow from the experiences they've had. So it's one of the hardest parts of writing series crime fiction, but it's also one of the most fun. It really holds your toes to the fire to make you think about how these very serious experiences of handling murder cases and sexual assault would change these people. And then if one of them, if Mike Chapman, Alex's favorite detective, gets himself embroiled in a dicey social situation, that's going to be interesting too, I think.
One of the books that really got me reading your series was that book you wrote about art. You wrote one of her books was all about art, and it was the most fascinating book on art I'd ever read in my life.
Thank you, David. That was Cold Hit, which is actually the third book in the series, and it was set, in the art world. And a couple of interesting things about it. The two, I was led into that because there had been this heist, art heist, at the Gardner Museum in Boston, and never solved at that point in time. And three extremely valuable paintings including one Rembrandt, were taken and never seen again. And just recently, within the last year, if your listeners Google Art Museum, Gardner Art Museum, and art theft, the police think they have not found the paintings yet, but they think they have just now solved that real heist, which I try and solve in fiction and Cold Hit. And the other thing, it's set where the art, where many of the galleries are in New York, which is in Chelsea, and something called the High Line Railroad, which runs through Chelsea, an unused railroad line, but the tracks are still there, elevated above the street. And since in the 10, 12 years since that book came out, the High Line has been turned into a public park, and it's one of the most beautiful parks in New York, elevated. You walk above the street for 20 blocks looking down, and it's all planted now. There were some scenes in my book that were pretty scary because there were needles and syringes from drug addicts who lived up on the High Line, and broken bottles and glass. It was a dangerous place to be, and now my fiction is carved in stone, but the park has just evolved into a magnificent part of the city.
Now, what's interesting is that Cooper, she's late 30s, right? 36, I think you mentioned in this book. Is it 36 or
38?
38, yeah.
And 15 books, she's gone from 35 to 38.
And I'm thinking, wow, she's only 38. She's still so young.
Right. it's such an interesting thing in serious fiction. There are great writers like Ian Rankin, who's a Scot, who has a crime series, and his character is Inspector Rebus, and he aged Rebus in real time, and so Rebus had to retire last year. So I was very conscious when I set out to do this series, like Sue Grafton's character, who's great, never ages, and everything's still set in the 80s, and Sue likes to say she didn't have to deal with cell phone technology or DNA, and readers who like your characters are willing to suspend disbelief, I find.
Right.
And so my stories are sort of set every 3 or 4 months rather than one a year. And that way Alex is only aging 3 or 4 months, although I'm doing it like everybody else in real time. So it's just one of those little licenses that people can, authors can control. So it's fun to do.
It's great. I mean, it's funny how you don't think about, until the author mentions about something that's had, maybe they have an ache or something, they'll mention that. You don't think of the age of your characters a lot of times until something happens, and some of these characters are really older than we think they are, and we love reading the story so much, we get so caught up in the story, we forget how old the characters are.
That's right. And don't you think, it's interesting for me as a voracious reader, when I'm attached to characters in a book and they've not been a TV show or a movie, part of the beauty is it's your mind's eye. I mean, you are seeing, you kind of develop a sense of what you think this character's physical attributes are, the author describes more or less, what the detectives look like, who the DA is. And so for me, I carry that character when I'm meeting her in my mind, and she doesn't, her hair doesn't get grayer as I think of her. She's that kid, DA, who's getting a little bit older, but not aging like the rest of us. So that's how I read other series, and that's how I hear from readers that sort of they read mine.
You're very good with place, too, and that's so important in a novel. I mean, sometimes you read a novel and it's supposed to be set in a certain place, you don't feel like you're in that place. But we feel like we're right in the middle of New York when we read this book, and that's what's so much fun about it. I mean, you just feel like, all the different spots, and you know New York so well. Obviously, they say write what you know, and obviously you know New York so very well. And there's so many spots you can use. I mean, New York's just full of places to use for crime novels. So it must be...
I mean, it's what I thought I could bring to the series. I think because I was a prosecutor in New York for 30 years, I saw the city in a very different way. I've lived there for 42 years, grew up very nearby and visited it. And so I love to look at places that seem familiar, but many of them, I handled two murder cases in Central Park. And so I walked those areas of the park. One right behind the Metropolitan Museum of Art, one of the most elegant, benign, you know, just a place where people go to hang out on the lawn in addition to biking and walking. And one that was in a spot I use in the book, in the ravine right under the Huddlestone Arch, a Brazilian woman whose killer has never been caught. So it's, I love using real places in New York, creating my own stories, and then there are so many exquisite places in the park. It's hard not to want to sort of show them off to the reader as well.
Right. 30 years you did that. Do you miss, you miss being a prosecutor?
Every day. Every day. I'm still, I think part of why I write this series is that, and I also I just stay very connected. The DA in New York now is Cyrus Vance Jr. Mm-hmm. Many people know that he's a great friend of mine. He was a young lawyer when I was a supervisor in the office. His father was Secretary of State under Jimmy Carter, and so the name is well known, and I go back and lecture and work with his Special Victims Unit and do Women's History Month programs and occasionally circle around with working on an investigation now, pro bono, that might involve a cold case murder, and so I call down there and bring it in, try and bring it in officially.
It's hard to get it out of your blood, I guess.
Totally hard to get it out of my blood.
It's like writing. I mean, Stephen King said he was going to retire, 10 years ago, and he's still writing.
I am shocked when I see that Philip Roth and I think Alice Munro, the short story writer, just announced retiring. I can't imagine not writing. Maybe not for publication, but I get up and I'd rather write than talk on the telephone. It's what I like to do. And
you'd rather be writing now than talking to me.
No, talking to you. It was really good. When you talk to somebody who knows books and loves them and is reading this one, I mean, you know how many interviews there are where the interviewer just says, well, what's your book about? And is never going to read it. So this is a gift.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very, very true. And people, I think that impresses people, authors that I talk to more than anything. In fact, that I have taken the time to read the book.
Oh, yes. It's just, it's embarrassing. I did one New York TV show with a really, really smart interviewer, and he just wasn't prepared, and he guessed that the book was about something else. And in the second sentence, what I found myself doing gently was correcting him. That's not the case the book is about. It's not about a real case of mine in Central Park. It's fiction. So this is rare, David, and delightful.
Right. Now, Lucy is very pivotal in the book, as we find out later. Are we going to find out by the end of the book what happened to Lucy?
Yes, absolutely. I weave in, in addition to the current murder, it turns out, because of clues, that it's connected to something that happened years before, not necessarily a crime. And so yes, everything, the ends are tied together, pretty, I think, neatly woven together, which was my plan.
Now, are you able to use any characters from your real cases? And not, of course, not the real name, but I mean, are you allowed to use what happened in any of your books? I mean, is that permissible?
Oh, sure. Should I choose to? I mean, I have chosen not to. There is a crime that occurs in this book that is based on a crime, not one of mine, but something that occurred in the park last year to a bird watcher in the Ramble, and I drew on that to then use it for my own plotting. I've never written about any of my high-profile cases, but what I like to do is draw motives and sometimes character traits, not a full character, but somebody with an interesting personal history that may, I think, contribute to why he or she acts the way they do. So, but there is no prohibition if I can't slander or libel anybody, but if I wanted to base something on a case, as you know, many, many writers will take a high-profile case and whether it's O.J. Simpson or Scott Peterson who killed his wife in the San Fran area a few years ago, and people will fictionalize that kind of thing.
Exactly. And I'm sure in your 30 years, were you ever threatened, like Hoop has been threatened? Have you ever felt your life was in danger?
Yes, I think most prosecutors who do the work long enough and a high enough level have the occasional threat. mine, not quite, certainly not like Coop's in this book, but I was there 30 years. I think the people most at risk, and you see this around the country, there have been some tragic shootings of murders of prosecutors in, recently in Texas. I think that the people who do the drug cartel prosecutions are far more at risk than people like me handling individual cases. I would have occasionally somebody who is really unhinged who might threaten, but some of the work, like drug work, is just so highly charged, and there's so much money at risk to these individuals that it can be dangerous, but I don't think on a day-to-day basis it's what prosecutors and judges think about, because most of the time you go about your work.
And that's I'm thinking about that while I'm reading the book. I'm thinking, wow, what would it feel like to be threatened, to have your life threatened, and not know if you walk out the door that somebody's not going to shoot you or try to kill you, and what a horrible thing that would be. I mean, how would you live like that? I mean, and yet people do live like that.
And people do. And a lot, you know, a lot of DAs, a lot of judges do, if there is a threat at a particular time, are given protection. I mean, it's not a choice if you're a prosecutor in the Manhattan DA's office and there's a viable threat. You would be assigned detectives to be with you 24/7. So that happened rarely in my career, but it happened a couple of times.
Is each book difficult to write? I mean, when you start out with, like when you were starting out writing Death Angel, I mean, you had all these ideas, but is the actual book writing much more difficult than doing the research?
Ooh, good question. The research is easy for me in the sense that I like researching. I love being sort of back in school with my own hours and my own tutorial. I learned something. I mean, this, of all the books, was the most fun because it literally, I had the park conservancy historian take me to the park and take me to these remote places to see. Some, as I said, that I'd done crime scene work at, and some that I'd just never been to or knew anything about. And then I go to a historical society library and get old clips from the park. So the research is fun and interesting to learn. Writing remains hard. It's easier than the first, I would say, three or four books I wrote, because I have now, with this, the 15th in the series, the confidence that I'm going to complete a book, that I'm going to tell a story, that there are readers waiting for the next caper of Alex Cooper, and new readers who will come to me because they hear a show like this, or they see me at a bookstore and are willing to give a new book a try. But what's hard about the writing is the discipline it requires every day to sit in a room and start with a blank page and create a story and a world that you hope the reader wants to come into.
Right.
So that's hard.
It is hard, and when you know when you read the book, I mean, as readers, we know how much work goes into it. Even, I mean, when you're like, well, how does he make all this come together? How do you make it interesting? How do you make the characters interesting? And, of course, you got Mike. Mike, why do I want to slap Mike?
I think a lot of people want to slap Mike. Either people, you know, get his mouth and that it's meant to be funny, and he's still covering Alex is back, and
well, there are times I can't stand him.
Right.
He seems much more angrier than in this book than in past books. Am I just, is that true?
Well, I think yes, because of the situation he's caught himself in. So he is very angry, and you know, he did a stupid thing. He had poor judgment and wound up in a relationship that will hurt him professionally and perhaps hurt him with Alex. And so I think he is, yes, you've identified, very especially angry in this book.
And Coop is in danger from a judge, of all people. I mean, would any of us want a judge mad at us?
No.
Especially if we were a prosecutor. You know?
Right, especially if we were a prosecutor and we had to work in front of that judge. And you know, it's not your case, it's the victim's case, it's the state's case. But if the judge takes it out on you, the prosecutor, it's the victim who suffers, and it's, you know, the potential that justice isn't done.
But at the same time, she's a fascinating character. Like that one chapter where she faces off against Coop is one of the most interesting chapters of the whole book.
I'm sorry, that
the chapter where they face off, Coop and the judge, is a fascinating chapter. It's one of those ones, oh, come on, go at it, girls. You know,
it's so funny because it's so different. I wrote the first four books, as you may remember, when I was still a prosecutor. And so I wasn't conscious of it, but I was much more restrained about what Coop would do professionally or not, how she interacted with Paul Battaglia, the fictional DA. And in this book, as you can see, I've moved way beyond that in the years since I've left the office. And so she's much, she talks back to the district attorney, which I didn't dream of doing in my 30 years there, nor in the first few books. And the idea of going up to see a judge the way she did and having the confrontation. Yes, the only thing missing are literally, you know, the cat fight to the end. I thought that wouldn't happen, but...
And we think to ourselves, boy, is she going to have a career to this after that chapter, you know? But that's what you need to feel as a reader. You need to feel there's some real danger. It's just not some, well, we know in the end she's going to be okay kind of thing. Yeah. We want to feel like there's really some danger here.
Yeah.
And it's so important.
Yeah. And I really think, you know, she needs to be in danger without it being unrealistic, running through a cemetery in the middle of the night or, you know, doing things that she would do.
Right.
So here's something that's right in a judge's chambers and her whole life, again, professional and personal, like Mike, is, you know, could be bowled over by the time she leaves that room.
Now, the final Jeopardy questions, which are vital to the series, I mean, it's one of the most fascinating things in the books, the final Jeopardy, the way they bet on final Jeopardy. Where did that all come from? Are you a big Jeopardy watcher?
I'm not anymore, and certainly wasn't from the time I was in the DA's office, because I was rarely home in time. It came from one thing and used for one in particular. In law school, I had a study group, and we'd start at 5 or 5:30 after school, and we'd work through the early evening. And the break we took, we couldn't afford in terms of time to take a break for a half hour of a TV show. But we'd literally watch the final Jeopardy question and bet each other on it, like bet each other a beer for that night and for dinner. So I sort of got hooked on it then. When I sat down many years later to start the series, 20 years after that, I went back to Final Jeopardy, which always fascinated me, because I wanted to show, I was particularly interested in letting the reader see how intelligent these detectives are, which has been my experience with the NYPD. Most of the guys are college educated, they're right. Very bright, they're wonderful to work with, they taught me as a young lawyer everything I needed to know about investigating a case. And so instead of saying over and over again, you know, Mike Chapman is a really smart guy, he went to Fordham College and he majored in military history, I figure the Jeopardy questions have Alex, the lawyer, with the trust fund and the good breeding and, you know, well-educated at college and university, at college and law school. This is a way of showing, here are these cops who are both very smart, and these are their strengths. These are the subjects that they know, so that when there's something involving military history that came up, whether it's the name and color of Napoleon's horse or something, Mike Chapman will know that, and it allows me to riff for a couple of sentences about why he would know that. It gives backstory. It lets him show, without my words, that he's really smart. And Mercer, whose father worked for one of the airlines, knows world geography. He used to, as a kid, sit in front of the maps that his father brought home of the world where Delta flew. And so it's fun because the show is still on the air, which would have shocked me. I wouldn't have bet on that when I started writing.
Yeah.
And so many readers, you know, connect to the Jeopardy question and do have fun with it. And I make them all up. I sort of collect trivia and love it when I can find things that go to the strength of each of the characters.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you took them right from the final Jeopardy questions on Jeopardy,
no,
but obviously you don't.
About myself.
People think, well, what night was that on? I missed that question.
Right.
There's something wrong there.
Right.
But this is the 15th book in this series. It's hard to believe it's been that many, but was there one in particular that was the hardest one to write for you?
Good question. I would say there were two. One is was the second book, and I think you'll hear this from a lot of writers, that you know, you've done the first one. In my case, it had more attention than many first novels get, clearly because I had the real job and still had it at the time. I was well known in the media in New York City because of the high profile cases. So it had a boost that many first time writers don't have. And with that came the pressure to do it again. Was it beginner's luck is what you think, I think, with the first book? What if I can't tell another story? That one, sort of the plotting for the first book, Final Jeopardy, had been in my head for a long time. So it's I was ready to go, and the second one I probably struggled more to find one. So you'll hear from many writers about sophomore slump and the feeling that it would be hard to do. It's, I think, the second book, the weakest of my 15. And then on a much more difficult note, personally, my husband and I had a great, loving husband and a really good marriage. He was very ill and died in 2011.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Thank you. And writing when he was very ill, because he was my best editor, unofficially, but he read my pages all the time, was very tough and good about correcting them, gave me direction. And so I had this sinking feeling after he died. I just put off writing for months and months and months because I didn't know if I'd be able to really do it again. And he, Justin, wanted me to keep doing it, and that got me back to my pages. So I think the last book before this one I struggled with, and this one I really feel he's on my shoulder telling me, go write.
Right. It's interesting you said that the weakest book in your series. I've never heard an author say they had a weak book in their series. That's very rare to hear a writer say that, and I'm very in awe of you saying that. I mean,
I think, you know, and it's funny, there are people who say to me, but that's my favorite, so it obviously reaches some people. For me, when I look back, I mean, I just think it would be terribly dishonest, and
right.
For writers say, oh, each book gets better and better. I mean, that to me was the one I would like to, I like the story in it, I like the setting that I chose. I would love to go back and do a strong rewrite of that book.
Right. And I guess that's going to happen with any writer. I mean, where you feel that one was better than the other. I mean, it's like, it's not like with children. You love all your children equally.
Right.
But although some writers talk about their books like their children.
Yeah, many do. And, you know, this is the newest baby, so I like this baby a lot. First child and very sentimentally attached.
Now, I know you know a lot of writers, but do you have more writer friends, or do you have more friends from your law background?
At this point, certainly when I went into writing, I had a few writer friends and people I admired and people who had been good to me in encouraging me, but I was in the law for 30 years. I'm still a lawyer. My husband was a lawyer. So I would say I have a legal community that's enormous, the writing world, I'm lucky because I'm both in New York and on Martha's Vineyard, and New York, we have a group that gets together once a month on a Tuesday night. It includes Harlan Coben and Lee Child and Mary Higgins Clark. So,
oh, really? You still do that?
We do that. We do that the first Tuesday of every month. We took this month off because everybody's sort of scattered, but it's wonderful, and we all discuss over a very lovely dinner what we're working on. And
boy, I'd love to be right in the middle of that meeting.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. And if somebody's stuck on a you know, a title or a plot line, we empathize or try and talk it through. And then up here, Martha's Vineyard is like a little writer's colony. Richard North Patterson, who is...
I was going to mention him,
Yeah, we had dinner last night. Last night was my first night here, and we had dinner, and, you know, it's so nice having been on a grueling tour last week. You compare notes, and where'd you go, what'd you do, who'd you see? So Ward Just, who's one of America's great writers, is here. It's just, there are writers, David McCullough is here, totally, obviously, great historian, different kind of thing. But it's there are times you go to dinner somewhere and you think, it's like a writer's colony. How lucky can you be? I'm
actually trying to get an interview with Lee Child. It's been a year, and I still haven't been able to.
I can help. If you email me, get it from Jamie, I'm happy to put you in touch. He's a very gracious man, and I can't believe he won't do it.
Oh, well, I think it's just a matter of time. I think with the last book, he was doing the movie when the movie came out. You know, and it was just all about that. But I had no idea you even knew him. I'm not surprised in the slightest.
He's a great guy, really, really.
And you never meet a writer who's really nasty and mean. I've never met a nasty writer.
We should talk sometime.
Oh, really? Well, I don't know.
Nasty ones.
Maybe it's because I'm just such a nice person that everybody, I don't know what it is, but I've never met anybody who was really nasty to me. I've met people that were standoffish, but never nasty. It's such a great community. I mean, you go to these Boucher Cons, these mystery, this is where I first met you. I remember seeing you at the Boucher Con, and, you know, you just meet so many nice authors and people that are so appreciative of the fact that you make time and read their books.
Yes. You should come. It's always in the summer, and it's always in New York City. I want to say July 11, 12, 13, but Thriller Fest is quite something. And next July, Steve Barry is the president, who writes a great book. And Steve and Lee Child and David Baldacci and I think Sandra Brown, we're all going to be there. And I think, you meet a lot of people, again, very collegial. There are panels. There are sort of single star interviews. There's an awards banquet. And
the worst part of it is when it ends.
I'm sorry?
The worst part of it is when it ends.
When it ends, absolutely.
I mean, it's so much fun. I mean, you go to those things and you just feel like you're in heaven. It's like, don't let this end, you know? And it's one of the terrible things about life. Things have to end, you know, and you don't want them to end. But, I mean, do you see writing 15 more books in this series?
Part of me does. This is the problem of having a protagonist who's an alter ego, you know, who has the job that I had. I think she's endlessly going to have interesting things to do. I hope that's true. It may or may not happen. I have other ideas. There are standalones I would love to write, sort of the bigger cases that really don't fit in this kind of series that I'd love to do. My first book was, some listeners may remember, was a nonfiction book called Sexual Violence. And there's a part of me, it was published in 93, and there's a part of me that would love to redo that from the perspective of ending that career, but that book had a chapter on the infancy of DNA. So much has changed. I would include sexual assault in the military. I'd do a chapter on college campuses. So I'd sort of like to do that. The publisher asked me the other day if I had any interest in finding a big case and doing a true crime book. I haven't identified a case. And sort of there's a piece of me that would love to do a young adult book. I think of Carl Hiaasen, Mike Lupica, who've done them.
Right.
And I'd love sort of a pre-Alex Cooper. Alex Cooper is a teenager, so post-Nancy Drew with modern forensics. There's a piece of me that would love to do that.
Yeah, Harlan's done that with his series.
Yeah.
Now he's got a series going. You know, and the possibilities are endless. It seems like you could do almost. Do you have hobbies, or is writing your hobby? Is law your hobby?
I have hobbies. I in the summer up here, I'm a swimmer. I love to swim laps every day. It's kind of
good for you.
Releases the tension after sitting at the typewriter at the computer, you know, pounding away all day. And I'm bicycling a lot up here, which I enjoy. On the Vineyard, I do it in Central Park, actually, too. Bike around the roadway around the reservoir. I'm not a runner, but so those are hobbies. Reading is a hobby. And if I have a long writing day, I always do some kind of exercise at the end of the day, like swimming.
Now, you went I'm sorry, go ahead.
And just evenings are with friends and family. That's my relaxation.
You just sound like you have a good life.
It's a pretty good. I mean, I have nothing to complain about. I got my fingertips in the law. My dream all my life was to write books, and 15 books in, it's you know, it, I pinch myself at, when I open and look at the backlist of things I've done. It's what I had hoped to do as a kid. So it's portable. You know, you can be a writer and do it anywhere, take it anywhere. So that's a real gift, not being at the moment tied to an office. And everything is good.
Now, you went to Vassar College.
Yes.
Now, from what I read, it was the when you graduated, that was the last year. It was only women.
Correct. It was a very different place, and I loved it. It gave me, I think, a lot of the fortitude and strength to do things later. I mean, it was really a vision of preparing women in from the 1880s to be better educated at the time. Matthew Vassar created a women's college at a time when women were not supposed to go to college. And so by the 1960s, when I was there, it was really trying to liberate women and put them in a world where they could compete with men for jobs and get real jobs.
So and then you went to the University of Virginia.
Yes.
Law school.
And that's where I sort of went there thinking I would like to find some kind of career in public service. And not prosecution in particular, which is what it turned out to be, and so I was very, very, very fortunate to be well educated there, meet great friends who are still great friends today, and that's where I launched into the district attorney's office in New York, which gave me everything to write about. I mean, which just gave me the second career.
I'm thinking about Alex Cooper, and her name is sort of it's sort of manly and womanly at the same time. It's kind of like a strong male name, and it's also a woman. So she was that intentional that you gave her that name that it could be a man or woman?
I'm laughing because you can't see it. I'm laughing on this end of the phone because I don't know if you knew this, but the best man at our wedding, one of my husband's best friends, is a really world-renowned architect named Alexander Cooper. He designed
really?
Battery Park City in New York. He has done the redevelopment plan for Yale University and Duke University, worked on the Getty Museum. He's a brilliant architect and just a delightful, charming, funny, loving guy. And I just loved his name, Alex Cooper. And when I was creating this character, I just named her Alex Cooper. I never asked him if I could borrow his name and give it a sex change. And so he walked into my first book tour talk last week, and in the, sort of 5 minutes late. And so the whole audience, when I introduced him, I said, "Now I have to tell you, that's Alex Cooper." And everybody turned around. And he's very good-natured about it. He's taken it very well, but I just stole his good name.
Interesting. Does he get a signed copy of every book you write?
He does.
Does he really?
no royalties, but of course he gets a signed copy of every book.
Oh, that's so cool. That's really neat. Do you still do a lot of bookstore signings? I mean, do you go all over the country, or do you just stay in the area?
I like to do a week going around the country. My passion is independent bookstores. I have enormous respect for the struggle to keep indies alive and well and healthy. We have two on this little island, and I'm actually speaking at one tonight and one tomorrow. But I went to Phoenix, I went to Houston, I went to Neptune Beach, Florida. I went out to the Hamptons to two independents on Sunday. That's how I like to buy books, from booksellers who hand sell them, who say, "Well, if you like Alex Cooper, you'll probably like these books. If you liked this history book," somebody just sold me The Plantagenets the other day. It sounds fantastic, and I love reading nonfiction when I'm trying to create fiction, because it's a different voice in my head. It's not being envious of Michael Connelly's detective or something.
You must have days where you wake up and you think, "Well, should I write a book or should I read a book?"
Oh, definitely. Rainy days in particular, you know, there are days just want to curl up with somebody else's good book. And sometimes it's a struggle, and I say, "Okay, 3-4 hours at the typewriter, afternoon, you know, take a walk, and then come back and curl up under a blanket with a book."
Is it hard to do one a year? I mean, is that something that you wish, do you wish you had more time to write a book?
Usually I probably wish I had more time, but I don't regret doing this, because especially in writing a series, the fans are very loyal, but they come back. They want that book a year. They want to see those characters again. And that's hugely motivating to me, because imagine if they didn't want you back, and if they weren't waiting for the next book. So just when I think I'm exhausted, somebody comes up to you in a bookstore and says, you know, I bought this one the day it was on sale this week, and I read it, and when's the next one? When will we see her back? So it's what gets me back to the keyboard. It's what gets me writing. And sure, there are circumstances, days and times where you think, oh my God, another 6 months would be great. But I like having a series. I like having a regular routine.
If they said to you today, you can pick any actress you want to play Alice Cooper, who would you pick?
Ooh, that is just a great question. It's changed, David, so much over the years, because I started this series in 94, and there were young actresses then who may have aged out of it. I think of a Cate Blanchett might be great. Charlize Theron, somebody suggested for the role. I just was opening emails this morning, and a reader said, I see Jennifer Garner as Alex Cooper. So I'm all over the net. Somebody suggested Natalie Portman.
The other thing I would say is that it can't be an actress who's too cutesy. It can't be like a Reese Witherspoon.
I think
she's too cute. It's got to be somebody that has spunk, somebody that has...
And gravitas, somebody who's able to do, you know, and that's where I wouldn't do a Reese Witherspoon, all respect to other roles she's done, but she's got to be able to carry off the serious parts. Alex has a great sense of humor, she's got friends, she likes to be with her friends, so we're not talking about someone who's just a cold, hard stick figure, but I agree, she just can't be goofy.
Do you get noticed when you walk down the street in New York City? I mean, do people stop you and say, I know you, or...
Well, it's interesting. I still do a fair amount of television commentary on criminal cases. So there's a mix of my prosecutorial job, because it was sex crimes, was very high profile. And yes, I can walk down the street or be in a restaurant and I'll get the, aren't you that lawyer who did that?
Mm-hmm.
Or don't I know you from TV? And now, interestingly enough, I get the mix of, aren't you the writer? You know, I see your picture on the book jackets. So it's not, you know, it's not movie star celebrity, but I get some very pleasant recognition from people who really respected the prosecutorial work.
I'm totally fascinated by the paparazzi these days. I mean, it's gotten to the point where it's just ridiculous anymore. But I mean, it's like you see these famous celebrities, and they're always complaining about the paparazzi. I mean, Sharon Osbourne says, "Oh, they should be licensed." And you think, well, you got into the business knowing that these people were there. So I mean, you knew what you were getting into. So
right, and some of it probably was because you wanted that attention. I mean, her in particular, but people want that attention. Fortunately, paparazzi are not my issue, not my problem. I just usually get...
But I guess I'm fascinated by what would it be like to not even be able to walk down the street without being mobbed or noticed or...
Correct. I cannot imagine just coming out of a grocery store, and I think of my women friends who are actors or... TV personalities or even TV news personalities, and it's sort of you can't even go to the grocery store without makeup on, and because you've got a public persona, and people turn around and say, "Oh, she looks terrible today."
it's
a worry for me. But.
It's weird. It's weird how people will judge like that. They'll just look at somebody and they'll say, "Well, they just instead of looking at the person underneath that, you know." And we live in such a society where we look at people and judge them immediately by what we see, you know, and that happens so many times. It's so, in some ways, so exasperating.
Yes, it can be very exasperating.
You know, what I like is the fact that Craig Ferguson has authors on his show now, and I think, oh, how cool is that? I mean, the second part of his show, usually he'll have Lawrence Block on, or sometimes Michael Connelly, or, you know, I think that's great that there's a talk show out there that does focus on books, you know?
Yes, and fewer and fewer, and I'm shocked we didn't book Craig Ferguson or try to book it. I did, I'm one of the authors who's lucky enough to get the Today Show, and I think it goes back to the fact that they like the history in the books and that they're not just, you know, sort of mindless thrillers without a plot or some interesting bit in it. And I taped Morning Joe this week, which is going to air. So they do...
very cool.
Yes. And another author, Will Haygood, who just wrote a wonderful nonfiction book, The Butler, that's been turned into a movie coming out very soon.
Is that the Oprah Winfrey thing?
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, okay.
And so Will was taping Morning Joe right before I did. So it is nice when there used to be so much of it on TV, and there used to even be fiction, and of course there was the Bookspan show, and I love those. I love listening to other authors, what their process is, how they create, what they choose to write about. It's, I think, just as a reader, fascinating to me.
And that's the thing. There's so many millions of readers out there. You'd think there'd be more of an interest in it, but there just isn't. I guess they focus more on celebrities because that's what people want. People would rather hear about the Kardashians.
Yes.
I frankly would rather read your books. I don't care about the Kardashians.
I don't care for the least bit, and I'm always shocked that people do, that there are these people without substance who are on reality TV, and why would you follow their lives? I don't get it.
Yeah, I guess we'll never get it. You and I both will never get it.
It'd be a good book.
But it certainly is fun to rib them, that's for sure. Now, book 16, can you give us any hint about book 16?
Yes, the world I'm going into is actually inside Grand Central Terminal in New York, the great train station built by Commodore Vanderbilt. Literally, this is the 100th year of its opening. And so it's got so many tunnels and nooks and crannies and secret places, and it connects. I mean, the trains used to go all over the country from Grand Central. They no longer do that. But I've had some tours inside and behind the scenes, and something terrible is going to happen there.
Oh, how interesting. Just like, what was that movie, Hugo, that was so wonderful?
Yes. Okay.
The invention of, based on the book, of Hugo Cabret, something of the, I can't remember the exact title.
I know exactly what you mean.
But what a great movie. They're just movies that really get to you.
Yes.
Are you a big movie person?
I am a pretty big movie person, and yes.
Why haven't they made a series out of your books?
We're actually in conversation, this has fallen apart several times before, but I'm actually in conversation right now with a terrific woman who has been very successful with other series and would like to be the executive producer and co-produce with me a TV series possibly for Sony. So we're talking right now.
It's interesting because if she wasn't already in the series, I would say Mariska Hargitay would be fabulous.
She's a good friend, and she's...
Oh, really? She's a friend?
She's a friend because when Dick Wolf created Law & Order SVU, his own idea to do, he based it on my unit in the DA's office.
Did he really?
So he called me and asked me if I would meet with Mariska and with Stephanie March, who's quite wonderful, who played the prosecutor in the first... few years. And Mariska has a foundation, Joyful Heart Foundation, which does advocacy for victims of violence, sexual assault in particular, and I'm on her board, so she's been a great friend to me, and I'd love to have Mariska in the role.
She's got that strength about her. That's what that you tell that don't screw with this woman.
That's right.
Kind of thing. Not like not to take anything away from actresses, but some of them just don't have the depth that I would think it would require, and I know it would require.
Yes, I agree.
I mean, there's just some that have more ability than others. What are you going to do about it? It's the same with any business out there. Well, it's been great to talk to you. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this.
Well, I appreciate it much more than you, David. I look forward to talking to you because it's such an intelligent conversation, and you're so generous to the writer and generous to read the book and talk about it, and it means a great deal to me.
Well, thank you. I don't know what to say to that. That's quite nice. Death Angel's a new book. It's out from Dutton and all your bookstores now. We've been talking to Linda, and this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.